Our first speaker in the second session is Eric Schwab. He earned a BA in product design from the Illinois Institute of Technology and an MA in sculpture from the Rhode Island School of Design. His frequent hikes on Pikes Peak, during these frequent hikes, he's encountered considerable evidence of human activity leading him to research the history of mining, logging, homesteading, the development of water and electric power, tourism, old trails, old utility lines, and aircraft crash sites on the peak. As a volunteer for the Pike and San Isabel National Forests, he has researched the Fremont Experimental Forest, the Skeleton Mountain Ranch, the Manitou Incline, and other sites. He has prepared exhibits on the Fremont Experimental Forest, the Manitou Incline, and Fred Barr at the Manitou Historical Center. He has presented his research to various regional and archaeological organizations. Please welcome Eric.
Thank you. Why did the Army's signal station on the summit of Pikes Peak fail as a weather station, but succeed as a tourist attraction? What did the World War I aircraft engines have in common with humans? Have you ever wondered what that goes on inside that metal building at the end of the Pikes Peak summit parking lot? That mysterious windowless building is USARIM, or the Alpine Laboratory for the United States Army Research Institute for Environmental Medicine. That's why I called it USARIM. Its purpose is to examine the effects of high altitude on human physiology and to test the effectiveness of new developments in food, clothing, and drugs to mitigate altitude sickness. Begun in 1963, it was not the first research done on the summit to study mountain sickness. That happened in 1911, when a team of Anglo-American scientists loaded their 10 crates of equipment on the cog and headed for the summit. This team was headed by J.S. Haldane of Oxford University, who was the world expert on breathing at the time. Back then, Professor Haldane wanted to know how breathing affects certain chemical balances in the body and how the level of oxygen in the body affects breathing. England doesn't offer a whole lot of variation in elevation for his experience. He considered European summits, but none of them were accessible enough, and none of them provided accommodations for an extended stay. Haldane knew Professor Henderson at Yale, who suggested Pikes Peak might be appropriate. There was a train running to the summit, and there was a summit house with a restaurant and room where they could stay for a month. In addition, Professor Henderson knew Edward Schneider, a professor of biology at Colorado College. The team came together in Colorado Springs on July 7th, 1911, and spent the first 5 days at Colorado College running baseline tests on themselves. On July 12th, they loaded their equipment on the cog and proceeded to the summit, where they all suffered from some form of altitude sickness. In 3 to 6 days, they became acclimatized and were able to continue their experiments, and an added benefit to their research was a steady stream of unacclimatized tourists arriving daily. Finishing their work on August 16th, they concluded that acclimatization was facilitated by breathing in greater amounts of air, which increases blood oxygen saturation. A coincident increase in hemoglobin in the blood enhanced the distribution of oxygen throughout the body. They also found that carbon dioxide in the lungs was a secondary stimulus to increased breathing. Following their research on Pikes Peak, Professor Haldane pioneered oxygen therapy for the treatment of victims of gas warfare in World War I. Professor Schneider joined the U.S. Army during World War I and developed a test to evaluate soldiers' suitability to be an aircraft pilot. This test was so widely used that it was a common greeting among pilots, "How's your Schneider?" Meaning that, did you pass your flight surgeon's test? While the experiments of the Anglo-American team were not sponsored by the military, they were groundbreaking and certainly contributed to the body of knowledge that supported World War I aviation and Dr. Mayer's work at USAREM. His research provided the necessary data for the FDA approval of the drug Diamox for the prevention and treatment of acute mountain sickness. During World War I, the Army recognized that airplanes could be used as a military weapon. However, aircraft engines had the same problem at high altitude as humans. Couldn't get enough air. In order to fly high enough to avoid enemy aircraft fire, the engines needed a boost in horsepower. The Army enlisted the expertise of Dr. Sanford A. Moss, an engineer with the General Electric Company. Moss designed a turbo supercharger for the Liberty aircraft engine. Dr. Moss knew that he had to test his invention at high altitude before putting it in a plane and sending it up in the sky with a live pilot. Pikes Peak was a logical choice. The Liberty engine and the necessary test equipment was loaded on a truck bed and shipped by rail from Ohio to Colorado Springs in 1918. From there, it was driven up Spencer Penrose's three-year-old highway to the summit. When Dr. Moss was satisfied the turbo supercharger was ready, it was brought back to Ohio and mounted on a Lepierre biplane. Lepierre was a French-designed airplane built by the Packard Motor Car Company. On February 27, 1920, Major Schroeder flew the Lepierre to an altitude of 33,113 feet. At the apex of his flight, his oxygen failed. He lost consciousness, and the plane went into free fall. It dropped for about 5 miles before Schroeder recovered enough to land the plane and then passed out again. Anyone deprived of oxygen at 35,000 feet should die instantly, but Schroeder recovered and continued his career as a test pilot. On September 28, 1921, Lieutenant J.A. McReady flew the same Lepierre airplane with a new propeller design to an altitude of 40,800 feet. Dr. Moss's tests on the summit of Pikes Peak launched the General Electric Company into the aircraft engine business. The company supplied turbo superchargers for the aircraft industry through World War II. In 1873, when the United States Army Signal Corps chose Pikes Peak Summit for the weather station, accessibility was not the criteria. There was no cog, no highway, not even a wagon road. They chose it for its 14,000-foot elevation and its isolation from other mountains, which they believed would influence weather patterns. As a weather station, it was not a complete success. They had difficulty keeping the telegraph line from the summit to town operational. There was a high staff turnover due to the hardships of living at 14,000 feet all year round. However, one other reason it wasn't a success is that they didn't really understand weather forecasting very well. As an attractive destination for tourists, the station was an unintended success. By 1870, General Palmer's Railroad was bringing tourists from the east to Colorado Springs who wanted to experience the west. They could hardly leave without at least attempting to climb the iconic landmark that looms just west of town. In 1871, the railroad's engineers built the Fremont Trail from Manitou up Pikes Peak to Timberline. In 1873, when the Signal Corps established their station on the summit, they built a new trail, which was longer but easier. Sergeant Beamer had grand plans for the dedication of this highest weather station in the world. The participants were to arrive the day before the dedication, be dined at the summit, bedded down in the summit house. Next morning, there would be a hearty breakfast with dedication speeches, picture taking, flag raising, another dinner, and another night's lodging. On October 10, 1873, guests left town on horseback, riding up the new trail. When they reached Lake Moraine, they stopped for lunch. Having brought more than they could eat, the remaining food was left behind. After leaving Lake Moraine, they passed a couple of Signal Corps men coaxing burros loaded with supplies up the trail. At 5:30, 25 of the invited guests arrived at the summit, suffering from fatigue and altitude sickness. They were looking forward to a hearty meal and a comfortable night's rest. The burro team they had passed on the way up had not yet arrived. It was carrying the food for their dinner and the stove to cook it on. Mr. Sackett announced that they had a sack of flour and a keg of water and some yeast, and they could make pancakes on an open fire outside. The disappointment of the guests was profound. After several failed attempts by the Signal staff to make pancakes, Grace Greenwood, a guest and a renowned journalist, took over. In time, there was enough pancakes to feed the hungry group. They went inside the station expecting to sit on chairs around a table, but instead they found a tablecloth spread on the floor, set with plates, dinnerware, and glasses, but no napkins. To accompany the meal, there was butter, a jar of pickles, can of cherries and condensed milk, and a demijohn of California port. Mrs. Greenwood was not sure if the blessing offered by one of the ministers was a divine Christian charity or a piece of sly satire. At night, the women were bedded down on the floor of the office. Some of the men slept in the next room, which had no floor, and the rest were obliged to sleep outside. In order to have enough air, the door was left open. This was an invitation to the pikas to come in and share the warmth of the ladies sleeping on the floor and scavenge for leftover food. Just as Grace was falling asleep, one of them scampered across her and caused her to let out a frantic cry of, "Rats!" The observers explained they were harmless, but it was hard to ignore their rummaging for food the rest of the night. When the guests awoke next morning, they found the supply burros had still not arrived. Enough flour to make another batch of pancakes and was recovered from a sack that had been trampled during the night by one of the burros. A small package of raw coffee was quickly roasted and ground between two rocks and brewed. After breakfast, the dedication ceremony was presided over by three ministers. A young girl presented the American flag to the Sergeant Beamer, and he read his speech. The flag was raised for the first time over the highest weather station in the world, and cheers rang out. The guests weren't about to stay for another meal and another sleepless night. The horses were brought up from Camp Howgate, where they had been pastured, and the guests proceeded down the mountain. At Lake Moraine, they recovered and ate the leftover lunch from the day before, and the group arrived in town in time for dinner. Grace Greenwood published her account of the dedication, and in spite of the botched event and notices published in town that food and lodging could not be expected at the summit, the tourists began to arrive in increasing numbers. Most arrived exhausted with an inadequate supply of water and food. Many arrived too late to make the return trip safely. The Signal Corps staff received these visitors with mixed emotions. The staff was greatly annoyed by the interruptions and having to answer the same questions over and over. They were inconvenienced by demands for food and shelter for the night. A couple of entries in the station logbook illustrate this frustration. 14 visitors today. Visitors are a nuisance and an inconvenience. 15 visitors today. Visitors are becoming fearful bores. Invaded by a crowd of 35 visitors, most were sick and half frozen to death. Such log entries continued throughout the life of the station. In spite of this, tourists were treated with respect. This is clearly illustrated by contemporary accounts of visitors' trips to the summit. Our host hurried to make us some coffee and to prepare us a meal, but we couldn't eat. Two signal servicemen did everything possible for us. These two men were so kind and considerate toward us that we concluded to prolong our stay until Monday. Hospitality was not the only reason for increased number of visitors to the summit. The Signal Corps staff were prone to fabricating tall tales, which always found their way into print. There was the sighting of the sea monster in Lake Moraine, the imminent eruption of Pikes Peak volcano, and the time that Sergeant O'Keefe's return to the summit was blocked by a herd of 700 black-tailed deer after being turned back by 100-foot-high snowdrifts. He encountered 6 ferocious mountain lions. Sergeant O'Keefe and his friend, Justice of the Peace, Eliphalet Price, were the most prolific spinners of these yarns. They would sit in the bar in Colorado City and make up stories. Mr. Price was also a part-time journalist, and he saw to it that the stories were printed. The most notorious of their stories was about the mountain rats. These rats lived in the caverns under the rocky summit of the peak and only came out at night. Since the establishment of the signal station, they had acquired a taste for raw meat. John O'Keefe had just returned to the summit with a quarter of beef. Soon after dark, John was forwarding his daily dispatches to Washington. He was startled by a loud scream from Mrs. O'Keefe, who had retired for the night in the next room. She came rushing into the office screaming, "The rats! The rats!" Mr. O'Keefe, with great presence of mind, immediately girdled his wife in a scroll of zinc sheeting left over from re-roofing the station. This prevented the animals from climbing on her, but by this time, he was almost completely covered with rats. He succeeded in getting his legs into 2 pieces of stovepipe and commenced a fierce struggle for his life with a heavy Indian club captured from the Battle of Sand Creek. He destroyed rats with every swing, and they continued to pour in from the bedroom. The entire quarter of beef had been consumed in less than 5 minutes, which seemed only to sharpen the rat's appetite for attack. In the midst of the warfare, Mrs. O'Keefe managed to reach a coil of electric wire, and being a mountain girl and familiar with throwing a lariat, she hurled it through the air, causing it to encircle her husband. She attached the other end to the fully charged battery, and in a moment, the room was ablaze with electric light. And then whenever the rats came in contact with the wire, they were hurtled to almost instant death. The bright light from the electric charged wire caused the rats to retreat to their cabins among the rocks in the summit. Saddest part of the attack was the destruction of their infant daughter. Mrs. O'Keefe thought she had protected the child with heavy covering of bedclothing, but the rats had found their way to the 2-month-old infant and left nothing but her skull. The story went viral. It was published across the United States, in Great Britain, Europe, and the Near East. As a consequence, visitors to the signal station increased dramatically. They wanted to see the grave of the child, and O'Keefe, not wishing to disappoint, erected a marker in which he inscribed, "Erected by John and Nora O'Keefe in memory of their infant daughter, Erin O'Keefe, who was destroyed by mountain rats May 25th, 1876. To satisfy the visitor's curiosity, O'Keefe had photos of a child printed and sold for 50 cents apiece. The summit's strategic advantages of elevation, accessibility, and accommodation attracted these 3 military activities. One of them informed our understanding of the effects of altitude on human physiology. One improved the performance of internal combustion engines, and one had the unintended but significant impact on the tourist economy of the region, which we enjoy to this day.
I doubt that Eric will ever be invited to write promotional literature for Colorado Springs. Our next speaker is Catherine Scott Sturdivant. She's been a professor of history at Pikes Peak Community College for about 25 years. You haven't kept track? A native San Franciscan, her parents supported Japanese Americans returning from incarceration. Her classes at Pikes Peak Community College make field trips to Amachi. She recently discovered that her birth grandfather taught at another Japanese American camp, quote unquote, Heart Mountain, after his World War II South Pacific service. Kathy is collaborating with members of the Amachi Preservation Society and the Japanese American Society of Southern Colorado on her symposium topic. She works frequently with Pikes Peak Library District and Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum as a speaker, consultant, and editor, contributing to most of the regional history series symposia and books since they began. Kathy.
Thank you for coming on this anniversary of D-Day. How many of you are familiar with Camp Amache as it's known? Good. Partly because this will not exactly be a talk about Camp Amache. This is a talk that'll show you I have the same bug as Mike Olson. We get geekily excited about new stories to research and finding the documents and photographs. But by introduction, what we call Camp Amache, or Amache by itself, at its peak population held under 8,000 people, but altogether probably processed over 10,000 as Colorado's only Japanese American relocation camp, internment camp, or more popularly now, particularly among veterans of such camps, concentration camp. It is on the National Register of Historic Places and is a National Historic Landmark. It is preserved most lovingly by a high school history teacher named John Hopper and his students in Grenada, just down the road from Lamar. So this amazing place, where I do take field trips regularly, inspired me to talk with you about volunteerism from Camp Amache. But I got a little overwhelmed by the excitement of some gentlemen. These three men. As you can see, Robert Fuchigami is a veteran of Amache, and so is Min Tonai. Dan Yoshi is not, but Dan Yoshi has energy to spend. And these three gentlemen were part of an email string that I got involved in mainly because I was working in so many ways with Amache, and I'd already thought about doing it as a topic for Military Matters. They were concerned about something that seemed a more immediate, alarming even, concern for them, an urgent one to address. And the other gentleman I've already mentioned, John Hopper, with his students in the back row, who's now been suitably honored in many respects for the amazing work that he and his students have done to preserve this site. It is the only complete footprint of a Japanese American camp that exists. But the new exciting and somewhat alarming event was a history mystery, which is irresistible. It involves a woman named Peggy Covell, who was a volunteer to Amache, not from Amache. And her reason for volunteering there purportedly, if you look anywhere on the web really, was that her parents had been killed as missionaries, Baptist missionaries, in the Philippines by Japanese soldiers, and that she wanted to demonstrate her Christian forgiveness by working at a camp for Japanese Americans. A second part of the mystery that you need to know involves Mitsuo Fushida, and I don't know if you've ever heard his name. He's quite over the web as well. He was one of the Japanese pilots, one who led attacks on Pearl Harbor, and very famous in the post-war era for converting to Christianity and speaking on many talk shows, writing multiple books on the subject. Supposedly, as the story goes, he converted after hearing the story of what Peggy Covell did. That leads to the mystery. And then we have Martin Bennett. Martin Bennett is a novelist filmmaker who is dramatizing the account of Peggy Covell's story and how that influenced Mitsuo Fushida. Peggy Covell had worked at Amache, we know that, as a volunteer. And when Martin Bennett tried to figure out where on earth would Mitsuo Fushido's comrades run into Peggy Covell, hear her story, and repeat it to Mitsuo Fushida so that it would convert him to Christianity, it was a logical conclusion on Martin Bennett's part without further investigation or thought that it might have been at Amache. There was no evidence of Peggy Covell being anywhere else where she might come into contact with Japanese in America, except the problem is that that would be Japanese POWs that she would have had to have met to tell the story to so that it would get to Fushida. And that creates quite a controversy because we do not want the image to exist unless somehow someday someone could prove the reality that there were dangerous Japanese prisoners of war in the community at Amache camp. So we have a history mystery. And it begins with Peggy Covell's parents. Have any of you ever heard before of the Hopevale Martyrs? This is a well-known story to many people who know about the war in the South Pacific, and particularly people connected with missionary work, the Baptist Church, or with the Philippines. I found many of my Filipino friends from their parents and grandparents know this story. Peggy Covell's parents, Jimmy and Charma Covell, were missionaries in Japan. And this is a picture of them with their three children. Peggy is the eldest. Peggy, a nickname for Margaret. As you can see from the mini timeline, they married there, they had their children there, they visited back and forth to their homes in the United States. When danger lurked, the children are all sent home. By that time, Peggy was able to attend college, and she went to Keuka College in New York. David, soon enough, would enter the military, and little Alice, believe it or not, landed in an orphanage after her parents were killed. The killings are a horrendous tragedy, very sad. Realistically, I can share with you now what I know from this research. One reason that the Covells were sent with other missionaries to the Philippines instead of staying at the college where they worked in Japan was because at the college there was more and more involvement of military officers coming and speaking militarily to the students. And the militarism is what was bothering the Covells, particularly Jimmy. He would go out and stand in the playfield where the officer was speaking and challenge him with words. He was spending way too much time with Quakers. This is the background of Mitsuo Fushida. There are multiple books. None of them agree, which makes it interesting to compare them. But he wrote his autobiography, which is the middle book most recently interpreted and maybe added to and published. He also, just to show you how famous he became immediately after the war, announcing and writing about his conversion, many smaller pamphlet-sized copies of his conversion story were handed out or sold as tracts for the Baptist Church and other religious groups. You can see who he made friends with, interesting situations, where he was basically saying, I now know that I was wrong to participate in the militarism of my home country and particularly to bomb Pearl Harbor because I heard this story. Now, his version varies. Sometimes, as in when he was interviewed by Merv Griffin, and I'm going to spare you the clip, but it's fascinating to watch if you want to find it online, he would say nothing about Peggy Covell. He would say that he was approached by a missionary on the street who converted him. But most often, his name is associated with the Peggy Covell story, that men who were his comrades in arms when he was flying for Japan came back and told him of an experience they'd had somewhere in the Colorado, Utah area in the mountains at a hospital or camp of some kind where they met this young woman who told them, when they asked her, "Why are you here serving us so generously?" told them about her parents' deaths and that her way of coping with it was to demonstrate her forgiveness. These men were apparently so impressed by this story that they relayed it to Fushida, who then was impressed into his conversion. This story is being publicized by Martin Bennett. Martin Bennett first wrote a movie script, secondly turned it into a book, and now hopes to raise the funds, as you can see from this slide, to make the film. So he is an entrepreneur. He is someone who is fascinated with this for very much Christian reasons. He's very affiliated with Christian organizations, and that meaning all sorts of things now that it didn't necessarily always mean, that word Christian. I teach at the far north end of town. I teach in the campus next door to New Life Church and down the road from Focus on the Family. So I have heard many definitions of Christian. And I think Martin is affiliated with many of the individuals who believe passionately that a story like this furthers their beliefs. And notice also that Martin's effort is essentially his life right now. And so this became for me an opportunity to use all different kinds of research materials. For example, you'll see genealogical aspects. A lot of you know I teach how to do family history and do a lot of it myself. It's a detective story. It's also one that's taken a lot of delicacy and sensitivity because what I discovered was that Peggy Covell herself, when she was still alive, and her family are very distressed over the years and still by all of the attention that the publicity of her story attached to Fushida has brought to her, so that she felt quite pursued and didn't want to hear it. Also, this story is one that rebuilds from primary sources, which is so exciting, huh, Mike? Primary sources. Okay, so one of the first discoveries of many, just to show you how I found a wonderful resource, is I tracked her husband. And you have to track her late husband through things written about him in connection with her, and his obituary was not. She's not mentioned at all in his obituary. But I did find it, and I found that this is the right man. He served in the Signal Corps, and by the way, when he served in the Signal Corps, that meant he was breaking German codes and translating the German into English. And in that wonderful, wonderful old-fashioned obituary, it said, they had a daughter, and that's all I needed to know. So I took her name, and it gave her place of abode, and I found her. Her name is Julia, or Julie. And I thought she might be rather good at answering my questions because she happens to be the now retired, after 36 years, I believe, librarian of Harvard Medical School. When I wrote her the first letter, I was very cautious. And her reply, "Dear Catherine, I am the person you are looking for. Margaret Covell Struble was my mother. I would like to know more about what type of research you are conducting and how your findings will be used. I would be glad to help you if you are doing scholarly historical research on the topic." One of the first things that she shared with me was I was able to determine right away some things we weren't sure about. Some sources said Peggy didn't speak fluent Japanese. That would make a difference to the whole story. Well, Peggy grew up in Japan. She did. She just got rusty now and then. And also, there are many stories of her motives for serving at Amache. The one that the family emphasizes and that Peggy tended to emphasize most in print is she always loved the Japanese people, and she'd never wanted them to suffer, anyone of Japanese heritage, to suffer because of the militarism that had taken hold of part of Japan. And here's Peggy's thoughts through Julie of Fushida's story. My mother was adamant she had no contact, much less special relationship, with a Japanese pilot who claimed that she converted him to Christianity. Remember that his story doesn't say he did have direct contact with her. I remember her holding up a newspaper article about the false story, which had a half-page line drawing of the pilot in his plane. She said, I never met the man. This is rubbish. When I was a child, the Japanese man made several efforts to contact her directly and arrange meetings. This made her furious, and she wanted to do whatever she could to hide from him and get him to leave her alone. So what I had uncovered was a family that is still distressed by unwanted publicity. First photograph from Peggy's family photograph album, combined with an article from Amache. The clippings tells us that Margaret Struble left on July 28th, 1945, left Amache, and it's revealed by her boss, Jacob Gerald Counselor. The photograph is written underneath by Peggy herself. This is my boss, Mr. Jacob Gerald. So you start to see that the things that Peggy had are now passed on to Amache as wonderful additions to the archival collection there that add to the story that they reconstruct of Amache. Secondly, Peggy's childhood photographs from her album. Growing up in Japan meant that all the nannies, all the little friends, all the neighbors, everyone around them was Japanese. They all spoke Japanese. They loved Japanese. An V-mail, you know V-mail? I love V-mail. I have some of my dad's V-mail from World War II. Victory mail. Peggy's brother David joined the Marines partly because of what happened to his parents. And here's one remark from a letter to her. Just how definite are your plans for going to Colorado to work amongst Nisei and such? You will probably get your Nihingo back in a hurry if you do go there. Had to call a friend from across the hall and say, translate, please. It means Japanese. Peggy's album. These are the women who worked at the cooperative store at Amache. Peggy's in the picture. And so we get more and more photographs and connections for Amache's archive. And then one of the three men, Dan, who's here today, Dan mentioned that a Baptist missionary who was still available had written one of the articles on the Covell story. I should perhaps get in touch with her. Roberta is a wonderful missionary and a wonderful lady, retired. And she gave me a document where her version of the story was completely edited by David and Alice, Peggy's siblings. So we have their entire version by editing her version. And one comment from Alice, which I'm not going to read to you completely right now just because of time, basically verifies Peggy's version, but shows some sympathy for Captain Fushida believing otherwise. By the way, Roberta is such a lovely missionary that she told me she thought my talk was last Saturday and she prayed for me three times. And then a major bingo discovery. When we were trying, those of us on the email string, to discuss with Martin Bennett that this could not have happened at Amache if it involved POWs, we discovered that there was a place called Bushnell General Military Hospital in Brigham City, Utah, which fits all the descriptions we found. It held Japanese POWs. There's one who died there, buried there. It had a hot springs, which was part of the description. And in one of the books that came out later, Fushida's autobiography, it actually does say it was in Utah. One more thing Martin Bennett mentioned. Well, Peggy could have worked there in those 2 months before she left Colorado area. They were, if only she had Red Cross nurses training. Well, bingo. From her daughter, Julia. That doesn't mean she did. We have no record that she did work at Bushnell or anywhere else with Japanese or Japanese Americans in this region, but there is that little gap of time. And in conclusion, I want to show you why I think this is all so important. There's Peggy with her husband and her daughter and son-in-law. Could Peggy Covell have kept a secret? Maybe. Her son-in-law said in her obituary, "She was a bit inscrutable, something behind that wry smile of hers, that soft-spoken serenity that lent her a touch of the exotic, a slight hint of mystery." And so the results of this, Martin Bennett changed his account. He only publishes on demand, and the movie isn't made yet. It's not going to happen at Amache. We're waiting for results from the National Archive to study this some more. I'll be writing this as a nonfiction account of Peggy Covell for the book from the Pikes Peak Library District. We have a wonderful network discussing it. More primary sources, particularly some donated to Camp Amache's museum. The entire collection of the Covell papers that survives will become an archived collection. Julie and I are discussing that. And I wanted to make one last point about what inspires me. If one of the biggest sacrifices, and it doesn't sound like much compared to the loss of her parents, but one of Peggy's and Julie's sacrifices was bearing the brunt of inaccurate publicity and being harassed, in their opinion, by a group of, or an assortment of people over a very long period of time, it caused Julia, the daughter, to close the door on the historical record and not know anyone she could trust. So my responsibility, which I take very seriously and which I'm very proud to carry, is to lead some of this material into the historical record. Thank you.